Hello, and welcome to Pod With Me.
And also with you.
I'm your host, Suzanne Pizzolatto. Joining me today, permanent host.
Nick Pizzolatto.
Guest, permanent guest. But you're the host of my heart, so what are we going to do?
Well, just happy to be here.
Yeah. It's raining buckets outside in Austin right now. We are, the plan today is to pick up where we left off with our last podcast, which was about second acts of life. We're in like a tremendous fourth quarter of some second acts, you and I. Mm-hmm. We have a baby on the way, 6.5 months pregnant with our son. We are also moving to which location we have yet to land on.
Yeah.
But moving to accommodate our growing family. And needless to say, it's, high voltage, high intensity. But we have each other.
Yeah, we do.
Fucking so. A.
There's that.
There's that. So I kind of took, I feel like I took over the previous second act. I spoke a lot about my own life. And there's so much for Nick to share. And so I really want him to take the helm on this podcast to talk to us about his version of second acts of life and your insights and experience that you're willing to share with us today.
Sure.
You stud.
Ask away.
Okay. Nikki,
mm-hmm.
My love, you've had a lot of big changes in these sort of massive, just like demarcations in your life where it's like, now you're going here and there's no going back.
Right.
And you've had a lot of that with your career. You've had a lot of that in your personal life. I'm sure people want to hear about your career. And I know we've talked about a lot of your transitions before,
mm-hmm.
but like over... you know, overarching theme.
Well, you know, I mean, I guess first off, when we say second act, you mm-hmm. know, we mean a radical change of
right.
plan, right?
That's irrevocably changed. It's
yeah,
not like, I'm
going to try this for a second.
Yeah.
It's, and it, you know, tends to bring long-term change. It's,
mm-hmm.
it's a fork in the road, right? It's a place where, things were going to go one way and, you know, by deliberate design, another path was chosen.
Mm-hmm.
So plans didn't hold
right.
to their original form.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I guess for me, I'm probably on act four or five in those definitions, but I guess for me, the most obvious and first one would be when I left my position as a college professor and a novelist to go to Hollywood and, you know, become a showrunner.
I think it's safe to say
scripts.
A lot of people are really glad that you did that.
Well, thanks. Me primary among them. And that was a change of plans that radically altered my life, obviously. But I had never meant to become a professor or
right.
something like that. It was more just that was the steady job I was qualified for
mm-hmm.
after getting my master's and publishing a book of short stories. And
which led into all this, too. It's like you discovered that, oh, you're a really fucking good writer.
Well, that was my thing. I mean,
an
earlier change of plans, I don't think it's a second act, but an earlier change of plans was in undergrad, I was going to go to law school.
Right.
Because I was very, 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 very tired of being poor.
Right.
And what I had reconciled with myself was that if I have to work for somebody else the rest of my life, I want to get paid really well for it.
Right.
So I took the LSAT. I did really, really well on it and had a lot of law schools sort of headhunting me.
Really?
Just off my LSAT scores. Well, it's not so
much
that.
So you were very serious about it.
Yeah. And the LSAT's a tough test.
Yeah.
And, you know, by headhunted, I just mean like I started getting brochures and phone calls from very big law schools about, you know, hey, have you considered us? And I thought that's what I was going to do. I had a bunch of electives to clear my last year. And so for one of them, I took an independent study course called novel writing with this really good professor who just told me basically if you turn in 30 pages three times during the semester, and I feel like you're trying. You know, you'll get an A. Nobody expects you to actually write a really good novel.
Oh, wow. That was his, like...
Yeah, because...
Disclaimer?
Yeah, well, nobody does expect you to write a good novel.
Right.
Like, it's a class.
It's just for fun.
Well, it's not for fun. It's a class.
Right.
But, like, if you're being judged on how good your novel is, everybody's going to fail.
Sure.
Because you got to be really good to write publishable novels, and these are all students, mm-hmm. undergraduate students. So I thought that was fair. And I just started writing this kind of stream of consciousness story that I was making up as I went along. But the professor loved it, and he was really supportive and, you know, told me, look, your LSAT scores are good for 5 years. Why don't you just take a semester off after you graduate and finish this book, and I'll get it to my agents. I'll help you in every way I can because I think this should be published. And I was like, really? Okay. And I'd been working so hard. Like, I didn't have fun in college. I was always working. So I thought, okay, that's what I'll do. And I graduated from Louisiana State University. And then I moved to Austin because I wanted to be in a city that was kind of exciting, but I liked the idea of still staying in the South and being more or less in the part of the country that was my stomping grounds.
Yeah.
But a couple months after I graduated, that professor suddenly died. And that was my last connection to sort of the literary world. Like, he was it.
It didn't occur to you to submit your own work to, like, the Atlantic by yourself and
submit
stuff like
where?
That?
No.
Yeah.
No, I didn't know how anything worked.
Right.
I didn't know how you became a writer.
Got it.
And then I was just a bartender in Austin for 4 years. And, you know, around 24, maybe 25, I kind of decided, okay, dude, like, you're getting too old for this. And you either need to go to law school or you need to give this writing thing a real shot. So I looked at master's programs in creative writing, and I was not a degree I was going to pay for.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked for places that took care of the tuition for you and gave you a kind of stipend for teaching composition classes or something.
Okay.
And I ended up going to the University of Arkansas. The first two short stories I wrote for that program, which were also the first two short stories I'd ever written, really, because, you know, who writes short stories? Who reads short stories?
I like them.
I think the bigger answer is people who want to write short stories.
Sure, fair enough.
Read short stories. But in workshops, that was the thing to do, was to write a short story. So I wrote two and didn't really know what I was doing, but I submitted them both to the Atlantic Monthly. And the Atlantic Monthly bought both of them. So, you know, I had told myself I was just going to use this time in the master's to focus on writing and see if something happened. And if nothing happened, I was going to go to law school, because I'm not going to spend my life chasing something. And, you know, everybody at the school thought they were going to be the next great American writer.
And did they?
Yeah. And
was it competitive?
I didn't think that.
Ah!
Well, it was competitive for some of those people, but, you know, to be honest, I didn't consider us in the same class at all. But so when the Atlantic bought those stories, I thought, okay, great, I can do this.
Right.
Published a book of short stories with an independent press. I spent 2 years working on a novel that I pulled from publication because it wasn't good enough. And then I wrote my novel Galveston in about 2 months of waking up early every day and writing a bit and then going to teach. And I had said to a friend, I was in Aspen to teach a workshop at this Words and Music Festival. And that was the first time I had ever seen actual rich people, you know, like where I came from, the rich person was the doctor that had three cars and a two-story house. And in Aspen, I saw like how the real rich lived. And I was kind of aghast at how unintelligent they were. And so I told my friend at the time, I said, you know, when this novel gets published, if I get to talk to anybody from Hollywood, I'm going out to LA and I'm going to get rich making TV and movies. And he just kind of laughed at me and said, you know, I bet no writer's ever thought that before. but, you know, this story's been told before, but somebody optioned my novel for a movie, and it was, I think it was for like $6,000. It wasn't, you know, real money or anything, but that was the first time I ever spoke to real Hollywood agents and asked them, well, how do I get to be considered for the script? And come to that, how do I break into television writing? And while I got you on the phone, how do I become a showrunner? I've been reading about that, and I think I'd be really good at it. And, you know, those women kind of chuckled and asked me if I'd written scripts before, and I said no, and they laughed and said, well, you got to write scripts, and, you know, gave me some instructions. And in 5 weeks, I wrote 6 television scripts, sent them to these ladies, who are still my agents, by the way. They were with a boutique literary agency at the time, and now they're with WME. And those samples, they loved, and they sent out, and those got me meetings. So pretty quickly, I was flying out to LA to take meetings with all these studios. And
which, like, let's just stop for a second, because, okay, like, you're breezing through some, like, incredible, like, acclimation, reacclimation, energetically speaking. Like, you're coming from grad school, you know, publishing a novel, that doing really well. And then, like, all of a sudden you're in Hollywood with all these big wigs. And, like, I guess my question to you is, like, it was really jarring to me the first time I made money from music. Like, I was like, holy shit. Like, I was excited, and it was what I'd planned to do. But there was this part of me that, like, didn't understand that if I weren't running around a dining room, like, how to make money as an artist. And so, like, my version of that was just, like, trying to accept this part of my life as a real career and a job and not just something for fun. And that's not what you were doing. But
No. It
had to be really just sort of mind-blowing.
No, I can't say it was.
It wasn't.
No,
so you just, like, went in like, I'm meant to be here.
Yeah.
That's cool.
No, yeah. It wasn't
jarring.
I believe
that.
It wasn't jarring for me at all. If anything, when I first stepped in those rooms to meet with executives, I was like, oh.
You guys are idiots.
No,
not
at all. I was not like that.
I'm just kidding.
No, I was like, oh, man, this is where I was supposed to be.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm late to this party, actually.
Right.
And, you know, I saw that so much of those meetings were sort of showing people who you were and getting them excited about your ideas. And they had read my samples, so they knew,
right,
you know, how good I was. Because those samples really opened every door, and I walked through every door. And, you know, my thing was, like, when you're meeting with these executives, I was like, oh, this is like a locker room. And I was like, well, I'm good in a locker room, you know? And I was kind of like, oh, these people want me to intellectually bully them a little bit. Okay. And I don't know. I was, again, I don't know where that confidence came from. But I had, before I walked in any room, I was completely positive in my own mind that I was the prettiest girl at the dance. and these people were all going to realize I'm the prettiest girl at the dance before I leave this room. And every meeting I took, I got offered a job.
Yeah.
So, you know, I fly back to Indiana, and I tell the university I work for and my family, so we're going to move to Los Angeles, and I'm going to work in TV and film. And we're going to make at least 5 times the amount of money we're making now.
Right.
And, you know, when I got there, I can honestly say I took to it like a fish to water.
Yeah.
But I did feel like I was late to the party. I was almost 35 by the time I got to Los Angeles.
Right.
And I guess it's good things worked out that way. Like, if I had just gone to L.A. like right after college or something, I wouldn't have known how to write. And everybody's, you know, rushing around, trying to get noticed, trying to find the right contacts and who you know and stuff in LA. And I just completely skipped all that part.
But you've never been like that either.
Like, no.
You've always had your principles. And I think that's part of this, like...
Well, look, I love the entertainment business. Yeah. And at the time I entered it, I saw it as one of the last meritocracies. Because when I went in, you know... They tell you, oh, it's all who you know, and it's this, and it's that, and blah, blah, blah. And every time you talk to a book writer about Hollywood, they tell some horror story about how they got screwed over, and LA's full of snakes and stuff. But to me, those writers always sounded like a guy talking about a woman who wouldn't go to bed with him or something, you know? like, oh, LA, she's a bitch. And I'm like, yeah, but you still want to fuck her, don't you?
Oh, my God. You know?
and so like what I saw was I'm a kid from South Louisiana who knows nobody in the entertainment industry, but if you have the goods and you have work they think they can make money on, they want you in that tent. They want you there. They don't care what color you are. They don't care where you came from. And I thought that was beautiful. You know, then when I was in my first writer's room, I saw, you know, everybody else in the writer's room went to Yale or Harvard. And I used to tell people, if, you know, like if you think TV's bad, blame Harvard and Yale, because they're the ones producing all the TV writers. And I remember the first writer's room I was in for this AMC show that was brand new at the time called The Killing. But my first day there, everybody had already been in the room for 2 weeks. I came late. And The Social Network had just come out.
Okay.
And so they were all talking about their Harvard experiences. Like when I walked in the room, they were all talking about which club they belonged to and stuff and this and that. And there were a few Yaleys in there, and they talked about what Yale was like. And then somebody asked me, well, Nick, where did you go to school? And I said, Louisiana State University. And here I am in this room with you fine people. What a country, right? America. So that was the second
act. Making friends.
That was the second act. Just saying, okay, I'm going to completely change my life. I had a tenure track position as a professor. I was really well published and, you know, had job security there.
So you had no guarantees going to LA either.
No, no.
Which I think is a...
I had job offers, but you don't know if like, okay, but after these jobs, are you going to get another
job?
You
had a lot at stake too.
Yeah.
But, you know, you had a family and
yeah.
And so
but see, my math on that was, look, if I work in Hollywood for a year, I'm going to make six times my teaching salary.
Sure.
So that's like 6 years worth of teaching.
Right.
So even if I only work for a year and flame out or something, this is still the right call.
Yes.
Right.
You didn't go out there contracted. Like you were still like, I'm
no,
gonna-
I, so my first two jobs before I moved is, I got a blind pilot deal at HBO for this show I created about bull riders. And I was offered a staff position on The Killing. So I went out there having that. And like I said, I thought, you know, if I flame out for a year, I'm still going to earn more money than I would teaching. For a while too, I acted like I was in fantasy camp,
right?
Which was like, this is temporary. I'm not going to be one of those dum-dums that thinks this is going to last forever.
Very healthy.
Yeah,
I was a dum-dum that thought those things would last forever. I was like that. I didn't think. I was actually talking to our oldest child about this the other day, about life and seasons, and that when you think about your life and seasons, and you know, I'm on this part of the journey. I think you handle the journey a little differently and you're a little more present because you know it's going to end at some point.
Well, you know, I'm just that way with everything. I think, you know, like if there's one thing I'm aware of, it is how transitory all things are.
Right.
And, you know, so I was like, I'm going to do this for a while. This is exciting. It's fun.
Yeah.
I write scripts really well. And you know, it just suited me. It even the script writing format, when I first tried to write a script, I was like, oh, this is great.
Yeah.
Because the sort of infinity of choices you have at all times as a prose writer are not available to you as a screenwriter. As a screenwriter, all you have is some descriptions, but mostly everything is action and dialogue.
Uh-huh.
That's it. And I found those restrictions were very freeing for me. And
how so?
Well, because, for instance, if I'm writing a book at the time, I'm better now, but at the time, you know, you're like, well, what's next? If you want, you can spend a page describing a tree, and make it work.
Right.
But in a script,
fill some space.
In a script, it has to be action and dialogue. Everything is movement.
Keep
everything is
interested.
Everything is character.
Yes.
And a character is sort of my jam. So I really took to it. And so that was the second act. And then my next second act was when I left The Killing.
Which was a big show at the time.
And they treated me well. They were so pleased with my work the first season that they gave me the finale to write. And I was one of the writers they brought back the second season. They didn't bring everybody back, and I got a promotion. But we were in the writer's room for a couple weeks on season two when, for a few reasons, I ended up asking out. You know, I wanted to do my own stuff. I didn't love what was happening with the show.
You don't like playing in somebody else's band. I get it.
Well, you know, I was told at the time, you know, this is really foolish.
Yeah, of course.
And
a cush job.
Yeah. And people, you know, work for a long time to try to get jobs like this. And I was like, yeah, I know. But still, I think I should go. And I was told I was making a huge mistake. But again, I was still thinking of this as fantasy camp. And you don't go to fantasy camp to bunt, right? You go to swing for the fences. And I had gotten a couple film writing jobs too, so I knew we'd be covered. But less than 6 months later, we sold True Detective in a bidding war, and we had these two movie stars playing the two leads, so it worked out really well. But that was a second act, you know, saying this is great, you've got this good job, there's some security here, you're building a resume. Oh, you're just going to blow that up and go do something else? Okay. But
I have a question.
Yeah.
Is it unusual for like a newcomer such as yourself to get in, to get into Hollywood and then, you know, sell this pilot, right? And then you get to be the showrunner too.
No, I mean, I don't know. I think some people don't really want to be the showrunner.
Okay.
And so like everybody does it different.
Right.
But I had always, one of the six original TV scripts I wrote as samples for Hollywood, the last one I wrote was the pilot for True Detective.
Okay.
And I kept that for myself. We didn't even use it as a sample because my agents liked these other scripts I'd written better. And you know, like I said, the first thing HBO bought from me was a Bull Rider show. But I really, I loved that True Detective script and I kept it for me. And I wouldn't like give it to a producer or sell it to somebody unless I was going to be running it. Like that was the deal.
That's really smart. Wow.
That was the deal. And at the time I was, you know, now I think... Well, now people do this more, but at the time it was kind of unheard of that a writer was going to write every episode of a TV show himself and not have a writer's room. But I mean, I didn't see any reason not to do that. I was like, I write novels on my own. Why do I need a fleet of people to help me write a show?
So you went into this second act, guns blazing, which I think is remarkable because, you know, there's two ways to get a second act in life. It is either forced upon you by God or the universe or your path.
Circumstance.
Or you choose to do something so wildly different from what you're doing that you're never going to be the same once you make the choice to go for this thing. So you get in, you literally just fucking broke into Hollywood.
Well, I mean, how did True Detective happen? Well, I met the great producer Steve Golan, who owned Anonymous Content, and I was meant to talk to him about a movie job that was going to be a remake of the Jean-Jacques Audiard movie A Prophet. And Steve had said, okay, Nick, why should I remake this movie? And I said, oh, I didn't realize this was that type of meeting, Steve. You shouldn't make this movie. And he was like, what? And I said, A Prophet is a perfect movie. And it just came out. Like, what's the upshot of remaking it? Like, at best, if you make a masterpiece, it might be almost as good as the original. And I said, I just don't see the point. And he goes, well, then why did you want to talk about this? And I said, oh, because I love the movie and I don't want anybody else to screw it up. And I had a take on it, and I gave him my take, and he's like, that's pretty good. He goes, but you don't think we should do this? And I go, not really, no. And he goes, well, then what should you and I make? And I had my iPad with me, and I pulled up True Detective, and I said, and I handed it to him, and I said, we should make this. And so, you know, I sent it to, he took it home and read it, and then he wanted to make it. And for a bit of time, Alejandro Iñárritu was going to direct it. And it's good for me that he didn't, because I wouldn't have been able to show run it the way I did. You know,
right.
They had all the scripts, and you have one of the world's great directors, you know, in charge of the show. They're going to shoot me out the airlock now that they have the scripts. But and so I wrote a second script for Alejandro just so he could see the pilot wasn't a fluke and I could keep this going. And he wanted to do it, but we would have had to wait for him to finish The Revenant. And The Revenant ended up taking like over 2 years to film or something. So we ended up moving on past him. And Anonymous Content and I wanted to get actors first so that we would go to market with a package. And, you know, the story's been told over and over again, but we got Matthew McConaughey and Woody Harrelson. And so now we've got a hot property. And we ended up, there ended up being, you know, a massive bidding war for the show among networks, and HBO got it, and the rest of that part's history, and things went the way they went. So that was my first big second act, you know, where you're not just talking about life transitions, you're talking about taking a hard turn one in another direction entirely. And I guess Leaving the Killing was a bit of a second act. I don't know.
It was just a ballsy move.
Like, yeah, I was going
to
say.
Your life didn't change that much other than that you did something that people told you not to do and you were right. And well, I think following your gut and your instinct is something you have innately more than anybody I know.
Well, and, I used to.
Well, we're always changing. But, you know, at that time, like.
And I was a lot more comfortable with risk. I was
right.
Very comfortable with risk, because that sort of came from, well, I never had anything to begin with. So like, what are you going to do to me? And then True Detective changed my life in enormous ways that, you know, still exist.
Let's get into some of the minutiae for a sec before we go to our next act. But like, so after True Detective, like, everybody wanted to work with you. So then you're having these crazy lunches and meetings with these mega stars, right?
Like, sometimes, people just
that want to meet you.
Well, yeah, but the bad thing was that my personal life was so unhappy. I couldn't really enjoy it. And I will tell you, I was a bit taken aback by the level of spotlight that was put on me.
Yes.
Like, you know, everybody wanting to know what I thought about various things that I did not see a reason why you would want to know what a television writer thinks about that. And you know, and also getting attacked and stuff, because now you're a public figure. And
right.
And the industry really doesn't like it when somebody comes from out of nowhere and hits a home run.
Right.
They understand the value of it, but there's a lot of resentment there.
They want to have some say in it.
Yeah, there's a lot of resentment there. You know, I remember one interviewer telling me, like, wow, you just came from out of nowhere. And, you know, I'm 36 at the time. And I'm like, you're missing about 15 years of eating Chef Boyardee and living in studio apartments while I worked on mastering my craft. But sure, okay, I came from out of nowhere. So that had worked out well. And I guess, I mean, my next big second act was at the top of 2020 when I got full custody of my daughter, Allegra, our oldest. And she was in a bad situation, and she needed me. And I felt I could not keep doing what I had been doing and be the parent she needed me to be. I wasn't going to just hire an au pair to take care of my daughter while I continued to be the Hollywood guy and do all this stuff. So I took my daughter and moved us to Austin to get her closer to family and to just give us a more normal life than you tend to find in Los Angeles.
Which I really believe most men in Hollywood would not have made that choice.
Well,
and so, you know, that's one of your best acts, in my opinion, you know. Being a hero to your own child. Well, and
thank you.
And caring for her in the ways that she absolutely needed at the time, you know?
Thank you. But I walked away from a lot of stuff. And I walked away from my show and HBO. And I had a lot of questions about if the industry was even going to take me back. But at the time, my focus was on her and getting her healed and just finding a life for us both. So almost exactly 10 years after I arrived in LA, I left and moved her and I to Austin, Texas. And the work was very slow and piecemeal for a couple years. I had kind of an adversarial reputation, and it was also at a time period where people didn't necessarily want to hire my particular demographic.
Sure.
So I didn't know if
it's
I was not
even about the best man for the job.
Well, that was sort of the thing is for a while there that meritocracy I referenced didn't seem to be there anymore.
Right.
It seemed to be more ideologically based for a while. And it seems like that swung around because, you know, it is a business. And at the end of the day, you need to make stuff people want to watch.
Right.
And not just filmed lectures about how people are supposed to live. But that was a big second act. You know, what do you call it? A third act or whatever. But
you moved to Austin, Texas in August of 2020.
Yep. And sort of left Hollywood at the peak of my success and didn't know what was going to happen. And so I'm in Austin for about 6 months, and I stop by this dinner party, after dinner party, and I run into you.
Who? Oh.
You.
Me.
Yeah. Suzanne Santo. And you and I, you know, progressed rapidly and intensely. And, you know, that was not something I thought was in my future, was a great love with a woman who, you know, matches my energy so well and is such a special person.
Thanks, honey.
And you know, I didn't think that was in the cards, and I honestly wasn't looking for it. And I sure didn't think I was going to have two more kids in my very late 40s and early 50s. But that's happening. So that was another second act, was getting with you and getting married. And making this family together.
I can say that was also my biggest second act by a landslide.
Mm.
And, you know, we both left an old life to be together and are still discovering what our, you know, career and talents are going to look like, you know, after the before and after of each other, you know? And, you know, kind of going back on something you said earlier about that feeling like, oh, this fantasy camp's going to last forever. I really, now more than ever, especially after becoming a mother and marrying you, really appreciate the preciousness of time. Mm-hmm. and and how I know nothing's going to last forever. And now it's like every day I just drink in the time with our kids and each other. And it's really powerful and beautiful to me. And I wished I could go back to my younger self and just be like, don't take this for granted. This is a nice wave, but it's going to peter out at some point, you know, and you're going to do other things.
Yeah.
And
well, you know, and everything is precious. Like our oldest daughter, who's the girl I got custody of and moved to Austin. She's graduating high school now, and she's going to start college next semester. And so she's going to leave home,
which is crazy.
Yeah, and
it's so crazy.
And everything seems so precious to me right now. Yeah. I just want to gather everybody up into my arms and hold them tight and keep things from changing. And I know they can't. I can't. But I think those are my big second acts. Leaving academia for Hollywood, leaving Hollywood for my daughter, and meeting you, and you know, starting this great romance at this age.
You know, I saw this thing the other day that I thought was kind of some cockamamie, some bullshit, and it was like a video about there was a famous actress, I feel like I shouldn't name drop, talking about like entering this like narcissistic abusive relationship, and there was a doctor overseeing it, and the doctor was like, the woman, the actress was saying, you know, he said no one's ever seen you before, have they? And she was like, they hadn't, and I felt like I was seen for the first time. And they were talking about this magic before like all this bad stuff, and the doctor was like, anytime I hear someone say this is magical, this is a magical experience, I tell him to run. And I was like, well, you have not met Nicholas Pizzolatto.
Oh,
and
well, that sounds like some bullshit.
It was bullshit, because I wanted to talk about our magic for a second. That like when we met, it was like one of the craziest things I'd ever experienced. And the only like words that feel appropriate are magic, or, you know, God's hand or whatever. Mm-hmm. That like it was those things.
But we even used that line, like the line you just said, the famous actress used, I'd never felt
seen before.
but that was really true.
It was true.
About how we saw each
other.
It still
is.
Yeah, about how we saw each other. And, you know, we've talked about this, you know, ad nauseum.
I know.
Our relationship. But
sorry, guys.
That just sounds like terrible advice. And it just reminds me of, you know, apparently every single woman on social media, every one of their exes is a narcissist. What are the odds? I mean, that's a really incredibly overused descriptive word.
Narcissist and trauma, I think, get thrown around a little too loosely.
Yeah, and, you know, guess what? If everyone you've ever dated is a narcissist, what's the constant there? What do you think's going on? You know? Well, fuck that bad advice.
Yeah. So our second act, your second act, really coalesced, didn't they?
Yeah. And you know, and the work has come back. I've never been as busy as I am now. And so we're doing good with that stuff. But at the time I didn't know.
Yeah.
I didn't know how things were gonna go. And like I said, there were a couple really lean years there.
Yeah. Well, it's an interesting era that we're entering, bringing in another child, trying to find a place to live that is really good for this whole family, that's safe, mm-hmm. that we can thrive as artists, as a couple, you know, as parents. And we haven't found it yet. And it's really hard. We're really stressed out. And, you know, I'm 6.5 months along. But, you know, every day we just keep reminding each other that we have each other. And whatever's next is, you know,
we're going to face it together.
We're going to face it together.
Yeah.
But, you know, professionally speaking, I've really been excited for you and all the irons in the fire that you have. And also leaning into my home life and my home studio and, like, really loving creating and producing. And like, I'll get on a stage when it's time to get on a stage, but like, that part of my life is really over. Like the touring.
Yeah. Like, well, like the part of your life where you're on stage 200 times a year.
Right. Right. Something. Right. No, I'm always going to play when I can and when it makes sense. But like, that was a shock to my system to like get out of the cycle of just being gone all the time. Like for 20 years of my life, I was just on the road, on and off, or for really like months at a time, you know?
Yeah, and I think
I never had a pet until 2020.
I think you'd probably agree that like whatever the rewards were of that, it kept you from having a bunch of other stuff.
Absolutely.
In life.
Yeah.
You know? And so, you know, I remember when we first started, you had tours planned and you were going to go out a lot.
Yeah.
And then because you didn't get the vaccine, as it's called.
Here, here.
Certain opportunities went away for you. And then you would still go out a bit.
It was so different, though. It was like once we'd met and once the machine's been broken and breaking down for quite some time. And by that, I mean just the nature of the music industry and even the levels at the top, like they do not make enough money to facilitate, you know, large productions.
Well,
the
main thing with that is music became free on Spotify.
Correct.
So suddenly nobody's selling CDs and records anymore and they got to make their money touring.
But even in the height of, you know, my former band's success, which would have been the height of most of my financial success, like I always get net and gross confused, but like we made $250,000 one year, but our overhead was like $215,000. Like yeah. It was like nobody made any money. It was just, you were always go. And it was a really exciting life, but it was so hard. And then it was also something I'd identified with. Like I'm a musician. I'm a touring musician. I'm a performer. And you know, when I realized that, oh, I want more than this. There's so much more than this. It was almost too late, but we got in and we met and it was just right on time. And now like looking back, like, wow, like what a massive shift.
Yeah. And I mean, I remember when you'd go out for a couple weeks at a time when we were first together.
It was really hard.
It seemed like it was hard for you. And you would come back pretty unhappy.
Well, because it was like I was going backwards and I was trying to reclaim something that was lost and it wasn't going to come back. And, you know, whatever success I get from here is going to be different. It's not going to be that. And I don't think I want it. You know, I don't envy people that are gone all the time and their families have to, you know, figure out how to be together. That's too painful. And you can do a lot more when your kids are younger, right? Like if I get some big opportunity and like I get to go somewhere for a little while, you know, I would bring the kids or, you know, whatever. But then you get to a point where your kids need stability. They need their structure of their schools and their friends. And like,
right.
You kind of have to decide, are you going to take them away from that? Or, you know, I think a lot of people with transient lifestyles or, you know, the nature of these careers have to make those decisions.
Well, I'm going to make everybody come with me if I have to go to
I know.
Something.
I know that's the plan.
Just
can you make it somewhere cool?
I'll try.
Do the White Lotus thing to bring us to Hawaii. What a brilliant idea.
Yeah. That is a genius maneuver by Mike
Well played,
White,
sir.
By Mike
well played.
White. Like, good for Mike White.
We're going to set this in Italy.
Yeah. We're going to do a season on the Amalfi Coast. You know? That's fantastic and good for him. But, you know, I'm just getting started with a few of these projects and whichever one moves to production first, that'll kind of dictate what happens to us and where it is. But I'm with you. I don't want our family pulled apart. I directed a movie in 2024 and I was in Vegas for 3 months.
Oof.
And everybody came to visit me a good amount.
We were there a lot. Yeah.
Yeah, but it was still tough. I think it was tough on you and it was tough on me. in different ways. But we did well. But it's not something that I would want to do every year.
Yeah.
So whatever opportunities arise in the future, I know we'll be dealing with them together.
Oh yeah. Well, and that's a great addition to our second act is that we have each other. And most second acts before this were a lone mission, and they were really hard.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, that's the whole point of this act is that we've got each other.
Yeah. Yeah, thank God.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess when I moved here, too, I was like, I'm not checking the pool for water. I'm just diving in. I don't know what's there for me, but it's got to be better than here. You know, when I left Los Angeles and I moved to Austin, I really didn't have that much money either. I was like, I hadn't played much in 2020. So it was just sort of like this gamble on myself. And it was a strange calling. Like I could not ignore it. Like I could not ignore that. I was like, I need to go there. And I didn't really like Austin that much. Like when I'd come through here, it was just for festivals. And I was like, it's so fucking hot there.
Yeah.
How does anybody live there?
Yeah.
But then, you know, I learned, there's so many things I do love about Austin. There's so many things I really don't like, but the things that I do love make it a unique place that I'm very glad to be in. But it was like, at first, like there was nothing. And you know, I moved here the week of the freeze, that big freeze in 2021, which like seemed like some kind of biblical act of being like, turn around and go back. Like you don't want to come here. Cause I got stranded, it looked apocalyptic on the way in. There were just cars stranded everywhere. No food, no water, no gas.
Because of the winter storm.
Because of one winter storm in Texas, which is funny being from Ohio where you're like, this is nothing.
Well,
what is going on here?
Yeah, it was. It was snowpocalypse.
You lose power and it's mayhem. But I persevered and then, you know, 3 weeks later, I got this great reward.
Well, it's also funny because, you know, you came out here with this stated goal of resetting your career and just focusing on your
just
career.
Focusing on my career.
And
that
that's
was my...
all I'm going to do. And then the funny thing is like, that's not what happened.
No. Quite the opposite.
Yeah. Like but in a way, you did reset and, a different path opened up for you.
Yes.
And so it was a hard turn in a way you know, I don't think you expected it to be. I think you were feeling you were just going to switch cities, but you were going to keep doing what you did.
Yes, I did. That's what I thought.
But you would just have a different city as a home base.
It was a little slow of a transition for some moments. Like there were some really good opportunities. Like if Gary Clark asked me to come out, I always want to say yes. Like if we can arrange it with our schedules, cause it's such a great show and he's such a good friend. But really not until Rosie, our youngest, was born, did I really understand like you can't leave.
Yeah.
Like you can't just be in and out.
Yeah.
And I was so grateful for that, you know, like.
Honestly was too, just because like, you know, I love you so much and I want you to be happy. But I knew, you know, what things were going to require.
Yeah.
And I didn't know how you were going to make that transition. And I didn't, you know, like before Rosie, you had a lot of fear and panic.
Yeah.
About like, I'm not just going to be a housewife. I'm not just going to do this. I'm not just going to do this. And I was like, okay, you know, fine.
And here I am baking bread.
Yeah.
Like I love it. I fucking love it.
but my fear was that, you know, you wanted to start this family, but then you might resent this family because
that's not in my nature.
Okay. Yeah. I guess it's not.
I have to tackle that stuff inside.
I didn't know how it was going to play out.
Yeah. And well, you know, and
so I had worries for you and I had worries for us.
Yeah,
because,
I respect that.
You know, if you're home all the time, but you hate it, like that's not going to be a life.
No.
And if you're gone all the time, that's not going to be a life either.
Well, I did a lot. First of all, I love you and I appreciate you saying that because it was kind of scary for both of us. But, you know, as you and I like to do, we kind of make these big decisions and then catch up to them later.
Yeah.
You know, it's right. Like, I choose you and I love you and we're going to get married. But also we have to work out a lot of stuff within ourselves and each other.
Yeah. Like, and we don't have time to work it out before get married.
No, we got clock's ticking.
We're going to have to do this on the fly.
But, you know, something I love so much about our life together is, like, we can't bullshit each other and we can't bullshit ourselves even. And like, no. My career as a touring artist was already getting more and more difficult even before COVID. Like, after I left Hozier's band, I did a headline tour in 2019 and it was just like not like it was before. Like, and I did really? It was like a B or C level market, mind you. I wasn't doing major cities and in places that I do really well in. It was like a little off the path, but like, it was an eye opener financially, and also just like, it was hard to get people to come out, you know. And sorry, I got a little cold today. You know, kind of going off that the next few years of touring, then after COVID, I needed to wake up to it and just be like, this is not the same thing it was fucking 5 years ago or 2 years ago, and I need to accept it. And now, you know, having gone through this metabolizing and letting go, it's the greatest gift to be where I'm at. And I was afraid. I was so afraid of not being a rock star. So scared.
That is how I would put it. You had a visceral fear.
Yes.
Of not being a rock star.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And before Rosie was born, I did all this work with my therapist and with a couple of books that really left an impact. There's a book called Letting Go by David R. Hawkins that is poetically written about different phases and stages in life. And I really dug into that because I didn't want to be a mom with a chip on her shoulder. Like, what a horrible thought to have this beautiful daughter that we have, two beautiful daughters. And like, mind you, our oldest, like, she's great. Like, she doesn't need me like a toddler, you know?
Right.
So we have a really healthy relationship. And when I would go and like, you know, you guys came with me to Minneapolis once for a show. Like, she was fine. She even sold my merch a couple times and we had a blast. It's a little different with our oldest, but when our youngest came onto the scene and you do have to, everything changes. You know, it's like the last thing you want to be is like some like, oh, like my, I sacrificed my dreams for this or like you guys are my dream. Like, this is my dream. And like, you know, but you have to confront that within yourself. Otherwise it's going to fester somewhere.
Yeah. Otherwise it's going to spoil. And it's not like, you know, like, dreams change and they should change. And, you know, I mean, part of why I could leave with my daughter was because I had gotten my dream.
Yeah.
And what you find once you've achieved a dream is that dream acquires all the mundanity of regular life.
Yes.
So a dream fulfilled is a dream that has died.
Yeah.
And you have to find new dreams. And yeah, it would be a really terrible thing to be like, oh, I gave up my dreams for these damn kids or something, you know?
And I think that's an excuse people make for their own inadequacy.
That is an excuse.
I don't buy that either.
You know, so now you have new dreams.
Yes.
But it's not like you didn't put in the time and effort to your first dream, you know?
No, and like, I still like get to be a rock star sometimes.
Yeah.
It's really fun. It's not often.
But you gave it everything you had to give. And because of the state of the world, you know, and the business and your industry, there were limitations that are in place now that, you know, I don't see how to overcome. Like as a business model, the music industry is completely fucked.
Like, yeah, it's a shit show.
It's not a working business model in any way. And it just bleeds the artists dry, you know, unless you're one of those figures that the machine is pumping out and promoting, and you have millions and millions of dollars of advertising and media being built around you, it's just not something that works.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter how good you are. Like, the model doesn't work.
Yeah, and I think it is safe to say that. I don't want it to, like, equate to that thing you were talking about earlier when people were talking about Hollywood as, like, a, you know, the woman that wouldn't sleep with them. Right. This is a little different.
Right.
But I will say, like, making my peace with it and still making, like, I'm making the best music I've ever made, and I'm better at music now than I ever was. And I just enjoy it. And, you know, I hope to have licensing opportunities, producing opportunities, and things that keep me home with my family, but I can still be creative. But, like, my happiness and identity are not hanging on this hook, you know? And that was a great gift. It was because if I didn't get love and to become a mother, like, where would I be? What the fuck would I be?
Well, I mean, can I say, like, you are now, even with all the stressors hanging over us, you are now happier than I've ever known you.
Yeah, I'm pretty happy.
And, you know, I was with you before we had Rosie, you know, when
it's
you
kind
were
of embarrassing to think about those conversations.
Well, when you were still going out for shows and stuff, and you were so filled with anxiety and tension,
yeah,
about the music business,
yeah,
and about performing. Mm-hmm. And it kept you in a state of agitation.
Yeah.
I mean, we were good and stuff, yeah, but it's like watching somebody you love just suffer needlessly. Like, you know, and you didn't have this lightness around.
No, it was a little bit of a Sisyphus, you know, you're just like pushing this thing up the hill and it's going to roll back down, and you just feel so wasted.
Well,
you know?
Since you mentioned Sisyphus, I do have to share an Albert Camus quote.
Oh, here we go.
Yeah. The struggle itself towards the heights should be enough for any man. Mm. We must imagine Sisyphus happy.
How about that?
Yeah.
I like that.
Yeah.
I think our second act took a little adjusting, but once we really like leaned into it, it's like, it's so expansive.
And I guess that's the thing. I guess if there's any message to be taken about this second act discussion, I guess it would be, when you realize something is over, when you make that decision that something is over, new vistas open up, new possibilities for fulfillment and joy and adventure open up when you can, But I guess that's sort of the thing too. Like, when you asked me about my second acts, every one of them involved me letting go of something.
Yeah, there was like real death.
And I really let go.
Yeah.
I you know, and I think there's something to that. That if you are going to fully embrace something new, you're gonna have to fully let go,
yeah,
of something old.
Yeah.
In order to make room for it. And, you know, I guess I would encourage people to just, If they're in a spot and they need a change, find the courage for it. And if you do, don't look back.
Yeah.
Don't look back. Look forward.
Well, thank you,
yeah,
for everything you shared today.
Oh, thank you. It was my pleasure. I enjoyed being on your show.
I enjoyed being on your lap. Well, thanks for tuning in, guys. We, as always, are welcoming any questions or suggestions for future episodes. We're still getting this thing off the ground, but we love just, you know, hanging out and potting with you. So send us a line. Tell us what you want to hear us talk about.
Yeah, DM me on Instagram or something.
Yeah, DM Nick because he gets them. I don't. Okay, bye.
Bye.
Cycle through back to the start.